The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Thanks to Richard Palmer for filling in on yesterday's program as we went through some final preparations for this Sunday's campaign. Downtown London will be heading out Sunday morning for the big event. This morning we sent out an email to probably about half the people that have registered and that agreed to go on our list for any campaign updates. And so we reminded them of the event this Sunday and Monday night in London, and also told them about the follow-up Bible study the weekend after. It'll be at the same location, the same hotel in the London area. So hopefully, of course, we'll get back to you next week on the numbers of people, the number that sign up for that that follow-up Bible study. So very exciting event for the Philadelphia Church of God here in the UK. 208 total people, total number of people for Sunday's event, 155 of them non-members. That's the total number of people who have registered. And of course, we're anxious to see how many actually turn out for the event. The percentage in the ones that we've had in North America, they vary somewhere between 40 to 75%. The second night, we have 158 all totaled that have registered for the event. So, as I say, we'll be reporting next week on the event and giving you some very direct feedback from the campaign. In fact, as I mentioned on Wednesday, we're going to attempt to conduct a live broadcast for radio on Monday afternoon or Monday morning, wherever you happen to hear or listen in to that live broadcast. So hopefully we'll have a hotel room that's relatively quiet and good enough for a live broadcast. We'll see. So we have a Saudi Arabian journalist who I guess hated the Saudi Arabian crown prince. He visits a Saudi Arabian consulate in Istanbul, where he's reportedly murdered by a Saudi Arabian assassin squad who might have been acting on behalf of the Saudi Arabian crown prince. This is a montage that we put out from Grabian, because as is just about the case with every subject these days, at least when you look at the American media, the fault lies with President Donald Trump. Of all people, and here's that montage.
We've got a president that has already named journalists as being the enemy of the people. So don't be surprised when other countries take on a journalist, murder him, chop him into pieces, and dispose of him.
Did Donald Trump, who has always been critical of the Washington Post, always been critical of his ownership, did anybody in the administration, did Jared Kushner, did they give MBS sort of a nod and a wink to say it's okay?
The president expressing concern that Jamal Khashoggi is a reporter, he's a columnist, really, and a critic of the Saudi government. That stands in contrast with a message that the president has frequently sent to the American people and to his supporters, that the media are the enemy of the people. How do you square those two?
I wonder if you look at what's happened in the last 12 days and you wonder if enemy of the people rhetoric, not just from President Trump, but also then from other world leaders, has anything to do with this. anything at all.
You say I can't compare the two. You say because this the president's attack on journalists is because of inaccurate and fake news reported. That's kind of the same excuse the Iranians use, the Turks use, the Chinese use, and the Saudis use, right? Their issue is that these people who we think of as journalists are reporting inaccurate and fake news about those governments. So you can see the connection I'm making, right?
I remember vividly a train trip up on the Acela when I talked to a group for an international group to protect journalists who told me it was within months of Trump taking office that they saw the worldwide threats to journalists going up. And this is kind of in the extreme what is happening now in terms of human rights, not only to journalists, but in several hot spots around the world.
And let's face it, we have a president of the United States who says journalists are the enemy of the state. So values like freedom of speech and dissent suddenly are very endangered around the world. And that's a trend line that I think is getting much worse. And so this vacuum of any advocacy for democratic values, I think, is putting people at risk.
So that's them, the media, taking this murder at that Saudi Arabian consulate in Istanbul and blaming it on President Donald Trump. And now people are calling on the Trump administration to cut off all relations, or at least the arms deals with Saudi Arabia. And all that the president and Secretary Pompeo have asked for here is for a few days, hopefully, to find out what actually happened. But everyone in the media has already determined what's happened. And the Trump administration is guilty. It's more dangerous now for journalists because of Donald Trump. No one's bringing forward any evidence, just like with the very public trial of Brett Kavanaugh. It's just another rush to judgment. And even if it's the worst case scenario where the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia ordered this killing, how is President Trump complicit? As some are saying, I'll play this for you in just a second. But with respect to the montage, the rhetoric that's supposedly making it more dangerous for journalists, fewer journalists have been killed over the last 2 years than were killed in the first 2 years of the Obama presidency. I mean, if they're going to come forward to try to prove that it's a more dangerous climate, more dangerous than ever before because of Donald Trump, how about actually bringing forward some statistics, some figures that we can work with? I've gone before on this program through the material where the Obama administration targeted journalists, prosecuted journalists. And we know about how secretive that administration was. This is from Reporters Without Borders, 2017. That's last year. The least deadly year for journalists in 14 years. 14 years. That takes you all the way back through the Obama administration, through the second term of President Bush. It's the least deadly year for journalists in 14 years. A total of 65 journalists, this says, were killed worldwide in 2017. 26 of them were killed in the course of their work, the collateral victims of a deadly situation such as an airstrike, an artillery bombardment, or suicide bombing. The other 39 were murdered and deliberately targeted because their reporting threatened political, economic, or criminal interests. As in 2016, most of the deaths were targeted. The aim in each case was to silence them. So, tragedies, all of them for sure. But overall, the numbers have actually gone down. You compare 2017 to those years during Obama's time, and it's safer for journalists. It's actually safer. The BBC, just earlier this year, in 2017, they reported that there were 82 deaths, which, again, see, these figures do vary, but the BBC said earlier this year, too, that's the lowest death tally in a decade, which, again, takes you back before the Obama administration, all the way through those years, when President Obama was targeting journalists at the AP at Fox News. This Steve Schmidt, he worked with the Bush administration, and now he's rabidly hostile toward President Trump, and he's on MSNBC every other night, it seems, to make statements like this one. This is clip two.
We are the American people. And when you see a president of the United States doing what he is doing to this country, not to mention the unraveling of the U.S.-led liberal global order that emerged from the horror and the catastrophe and out of the death camps and the ruin of a war that killed 80 million people, his fidelity to democracy is nil. Yeah. His fidelity to small L liberalism is not there. And you see it with his complicity, and it is complicity in the murder of a Washington Post columnist by a Middle Eastern thug.
Complicit. So Donald Trump was somehow involved, indirectly, but involved in this brutal murder. So says a commentator on MSNBC. I mean, the selective outrage here, it's almost nauseating. You look at all of the funding the United States provided to Saudi Arabia back during the Obama years, back when there were all these human rights violations, all these beheadings, and an American president literally bowing down to the Saudi king. And then in the case of Iran, bundling up hundreds of millions of dollars and then airlifting it to the mullahs in Tehran, flying it in, unloading it on the tarmac. And how many thugs, to use the word that Steve Schmidt used, how many thugs donated to the Clinton Foundation? Where were all these outraged commentators from 2009 to 2016? What would they have said during World War II when the United States and Britain worked alongside Stalin to squash Nazism? I mean, it's an evil world. It's a complicated world. It's not God's world. There's no way around that. And some of these atrocities that we hear about on a daily basis, just the most gruesome crimes against humanity, it's going on all the time. Well, Obama himself targeted journalists. As I say, Obama himself targeted Americans. He killed Americans abroad. Maybe not in the same manner that this man was murdered in that Saudi Arabian consulate in Istanbul. But still, he killed them nonetheless with drone strikes. This New York Times piece from 2 years ago. Listen to this. This was right before the election. And it got a little bit of publicity, not nearly enough, though. The Kingdom of Saudi Arabia donated more than $10 million to the Clinton Foundation. Through a foundation, so did the son-in-law of a former Ukrainian president whose government was widely criticized for corruption and the murder of journalists. This former Ukrainian president. And of course, you could go into all of the journalists that Vladimir Putin has killed, assassinated, during the Obama years when they were working so hard to reset the button. Remember that? Reset relations with the button? It says the Clinton Foundation has accepted tens of millions of dollars from countries that the State Department before, during, and after Mrs. Clinton's time as secretary criticized for their records on sex discrimination and other human rights issues. The countries include Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Qatar, Kuwait, Oman, Brunei, and Algeria. It says further on in the piece, Saudi Arabia has been particularly generous to the foundation. The kingdom gave between $10 million and $25 million to the Clinton Foundation. At least $1 million more was donated by Friends of Saudi Arabia, which was co-founded by a Saudi prince. All of these thugs, like Steve Schmidt says, contributing, buying arms from the Obama administration. I'll get into that in a little bit. But here are all of these commentators manufacturing outrage over something that in the history of man really has been pretty much routine. I mean, it's in some ways it's pick your poison in the Middle East. Who do you side with? I mean, besides Israel, these kinds of atrocities go on all the time. And so what are you going to do? Pull out all of those arms from Saudi Arabia so that Iran just runs roughshod across the region? I guess that's what so many of these outraged media types are suggesting. And in their heart of hearts, of course, they side with Iran. They did all during the Obama years because that's the echo chamber that the Obama administration helped to manufacture. All those reporters that Ben Rhodes bragged about duping. Eugene Robinson, he's the columnist at, either the New York Times or the Washington Post. I guess it's the Post. It says, when the United States does not stand up for human rights and freedom of expression, there are tragic consequences. The apparent torture and murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi is one of them. From the beginning, President Trump and his advisors have given Saudi Arabia's de facto ruler, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, a green light to do whatever he wants. And so we played that clip earlier in the week, President Trump saying, look, let's get to the truth of it. Let's find out what actually happened. And as for the $110 billion arrangement, the arms sales to Saudi Arabia, I mean, if they're not going to get them from the U.S., they're going to get the arms from some other nation. That's what the president said earlier this week. And that's unacceptable to Eugene Robinson and some of these others. Because, well, he contributed to the Washington Post, and he had a house in the United States. But he's Saudi Arabian. He has ties to Muslim Brotherhood. There's more to the story, as always. Lots of those bits, though, are routinely left out. Ties to the Muslim Brotherhood that the Washington Post is quite happy to create space for. Well, that's not a big surprise there. But what about this selective outrage? How could anyone have close association with or ties to Saudi Arabia, given what happened at that consulate? Well, then let's look at what's happened over the years with respect to Saudi Arabia and its human rights record overall. And let's look at the lack of action on the part of Barack Obama when atrocities were happening. Well, pick your place. Syria, Crimea, Iran, all across the Middle East, China. But here comes the Washington Post, its op-ed writer, one of the featured commentators on the nightly news shows. He says Trump's reaction to Khashoggi's apparent assassination, he has to say apparent because we don't even know if it was an assassination. And we certainly don't know if the Crown Prince was behind it. Trump's reaction to Khashoggi's apparent assassination has been stomach-turning and disgraceful. See, we don't even know what happened, but we know that the way President Trump has responded is a disgrace. We know it's a disgrace. I mean, have these commentators even looked at what the president has actually said? Have they looked at is it unreasonable for the Secretary of State, as he's talked to some of these world leaders, to say, well, give us a few days so that we can figure out what happened? They know. They know when Trump is wrong, and here's another story with all the manufactured outrage that's being used to go after the president of the United States, not after the Saudi crown prince. The real target here is President Trump. Eugene Robinson says here at the end, I don't know if the president could have said or done anything that would have kept the Saudis from horrifically taking Jamal Khashoggi's life, but I do know that Trump didn't even try. He didn't even try to save that poor man's life. Well, go back. Look at the human rights record for Saudi Arabia. Look at it. Pick any year. Pick 2009, the first year that Obama was in office. This is according to the 2009 Country Reports on Human Rights Practices. It says, during the year, the following significant human rights problems were reported in Saudi Arabia. No right to change the government peacefully, disappearances, torture, physical abuse, poor prison and detention center conditions, arbitrary arrest and incommunicado detention, denial of public trials and lack of due process in the judicial system, political prisoners, restrictions on civil liberties such as freedoms of speech, including the internet, assembly, association, movement, and severe restrictions on religious freedom, corruption and lack of government transparency, violence against women, violations of the rights of children, and discrimination on the basis of gender, religion, sect, and ethnicity were common. These were common. During that year alone, the media reported that the government had announced 64 beheadings. 64 beheadings in Saudi Arabia in 2009. And what else was going on during those years? Well, this is from Reuters. 2016. A report from 2016, it says, U.S. President Barack Obama's administration has offered Saudi Arabia more than $115 billion in weapons, other military equipment and training, and the most of any U.S. administration in the 71 years of the U.S.-Saudi Arabia alliance. Barack Obama sold them more arms than anyone else over the course of that 71-year alliance. It says the report authored by William Harding of the U.S.-based Center of International Policy said the offers were made in 42 separate deals, and the majority of the equipment has not yet been delivered. I mean, they're still following through on delivery for deals made during the Obama years. It says the report said U.S. arms offers to Saudi Arabia since Obama took office in January 2009 have included everything from small arms and ammunition to tanks, attack helicopters, air-to-ground missiles, missile defense ships, and warships. Washington also provides maintenance and training to Saudi security forces. It says further on, Washington's arms sales to Riyadh recently have come under fire from rights groups and some members of Congress are disturbed by the rising number of civilian casualties in the war in Yemen, where a coalition led by Saudi Arabia is fighting Iran-allied Houthi rebels. So it's basically a war between Saudi Arabia and Iran, and there's civilian casualties to go with it. Collateral damage. And some were raising concerns there at the end of the Obama administration. It says here, Washington has been at pains to prove to Saudi Arabia and other Gulf allies that it remains committed to their defense against Iran in the wake of a multinational deal last year to restrict the Iranian nuclear program. So the Obama administration, you know all about the Iran nuclear deal. And then the nations that were up in arms saying, look, you're just clearing the path for them to build the bomb. And so to reassure those nations, the Obama administration basically went on a selling spree, selling arms all across the Middle East. I mean, it's the Obama administration who's largely responsible for the arms race in the Middle East. U.S. weapons exports increased 43% under Obama. That's from PRI. from early 2017. The United States continued to lead the world in arms exports in 2016, netting a 43% increase in sales since President Obama took office in 2009. Here's one from The Atlantic. I forgot to record the date, but this was toward the end of the Obama administration. It says it spent 8 years quietly selling a lot of arms to Saudi Arabia. When President Obama left office, for example, the United States still had $100 billion in the foreign military sales pipeline with Saudi Arabia, and in 2011 had inked what was previously the largest arms sale in U.S. history with the kingdom, a $29 billion deal to sell F-15s to the Saudis. It says Obama-era sales to Saudi Arabia were in keeping with sales to other Gulf states. So right across the line, Qatar, I mean, you go down the line, they're being supplied by the U.S. primarily. Overall, this is from The Atlantic. This is from the left-leaning Atlantic. Overall, the Arab Gulf states went on a spending spree during the Obama years, and most of the money was spent on American arms. Which begs the question, how much of this was sold to thugs? Thugs who behead people or who persecute women or anything else that might offend our Western sensibilities. I mean, for that matter, when was there ever a reaction coming from the radical left to do something, to say something, to do something to that relationship when they were American reporters getting their heads cut off? That happened time and again during the Obama years. You forget all the names. There were so many of them. But finally, there's this gruesome attack on a Muslim Brotherhood member, and that's a step too far in the minds of the radical left. Where were those voices? Where was the outrage in response to Benghazi? Well, we've got to do something. We've got to come down hard on Libya. We've got to break up these relations because of that attack. Where were those voices? I mean, you certainly heard some from the right who were upset, and rightfully so. A U.S. consulate attacked, 4 Americans murdered. And the president, as I said recently, the president at that time, he's off to a campaign a few hours later. Did you hear any reports coming from MSNBC or CNN about complicity, whether with Susan Rice, Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama? Now, as I say, you've got a Saudi Arabian citizen, a journalist who hates the crown prince. You've got a Saudi Arabian consulate in Turkey. Turkey, by the way, persecutes a lot of journalists as well. So who can you really trust here? This might have happened. Maybe it was recorded. What do the Turks have on them? And then this is what Saudi Arabia says. And yet these reporters are demanding that Donald Trump come forward and issue his decree. This is what happened. This is what I'm going to do. They can't even wait for a few days to try to figure out what happened. Listen to this one from Roger Simon at PJ Media. Here again, he's talking about the reaction in the media and President Trump's response. He's quoted in this AP piece recently, "I think we have to find out what happened first. Here we go again with, you know, you're guilty until proven innocent. I don't like that," President Trump said. "We just went through that with Justice Kavanaugh, and he was innocent all the way as far as I'm concerned." Oh, they don't like that. I mean, he's not supposed to say that because we in the media, we've decided that the judge was guilty. And now we've decided that the crown prince is guilty. And that worse still, Donald Trump is in cahoots with that crown prince. He's complicit in this murder. It says the AP was quick to remind us that the president was again swimming against the tide. It quotes the AP. He said it was too early to say whether he endorsed other countries' actions. I have to find out what happened, President Trump said. But his complaint about guilty until proven innocent and comparison to the Kavanaugh situation suggested he was giving the Saudis more leeway than other U.S. allies. See, look, we're the Associated Press, and there's a few other allies that have come out and condemned this action. Where is Donald Trump? Well, Roger Simon says here, okay, but which allies? Turkey? In the despot derby, their president, Recep Erdogan, seems to be running at least neck and neck with Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, and may be out front by a nose or more. Which one has more journalists in jail? Turkey, hands down. I seem to remember Barack Obama saying that he was really close to Erdogan, that Erdogan was one of his best friends. The same Erdogan that puts journalists in jail, dozens and dozens of them. Which one has beheaded more of its citizens? The nod goes to Saudi Arabia. Equal or ahead of them on all counts? Well, that would be Iran. Roger Simon says, in the Middle East, suffused as it is by the Islamic doctrine of taqiyya, making it permissible, often required, to lie to the non-Muslim for the good of the faith, it's hard to discern who's telling the truth or anything close. So is it logical then for the president to say, we need a few days to try to figure out what happened? It's hard to get to the truth when you have a religion that, like he just quoted, believes that it's okay to lie to the infidel. Simon says, Trump says he's reacting to vehement disavowals from MBS, that's bin Salman, and his father, that they ordered Khashoggi's death, but are they to be trusted? Westerners may have good instincts about the hysterics of Dr. Blasey Ford, but are less likely to be able to comprehend a culture more insular, determined, and bloodthirsty than the mafia. It says the Khashoggi story has no one close to a hero, not even perhaps especially its subject, who was for decades part of the Wahhabi government, so in love with beheadings. The disappeared so-called journalist, actually a lifelong activist for the Muslim Brotherhood, the Islamist organization that sought and still covertly seeks world domination through the likes of Osama bin Laden and Ayman al-Zawahiri, is scarcely someone to be admired, even with his Washington Post bylines. See, we're supposed to admire him now because he wrote a column at the Washington Post. I mean, it's as if he's a full-fledged American citizen. It says here, and of course, the USA has for years practiced targeted assassinations via drones and other methods. Well, that happened, and Simon doesn't necessarily dwell on it. But all that happened during the Obama years. They fessed up to that in 2013. My father writes about it in America Under Attack. And just drone strikes in general. President Obama launched 5 times more drone strikes than President Bush. And in half the time, that's from America Under Attack in 2013. I mean, we were only halfway into the Obama years. But like my father brought out in that booklet, this is an administration. This was a president who believed that he could go out and kill American citizens abroad. Well, they were terrorists, okay, but they are U.S. citizens. Due process. You might remember the quote from Judge Napolitano. My father refers to it in America Under Attack, he says, Napolitano does, Mr. Obama has argued that he can kill Americans whose deaths he believes will keep us all safer without any due process whatsoever. No law authorizes that. His attorney general has argued that the president's careful consideration of each target and the narrow use of deadly force are an adequate and constitutional substitute for due process. The judge says no court has ever approved that. It wouldn't be approved by a court in the United States. And yet his was an administration that just carried out these targeted attacks on American citizens abroad. Let me just finish with this Roger Simon piece. This is at PJ Media. And he says here, if Bin Salman is responsible for the death of Khashoggi, one wonders why he chose such an obvious and barbaric method, less subtle and deniable, even than the way North Korea's Kim poisoned his stepbrother. Perhaps MBS was even inspired by us, thinking we would disregard such an action since we do it ourselves. On the other hand, listen to this. If the actions were performed by some of the Crown Prince's adversaries, it seems to have been a good way to embarrass him seriously and to remove him from leadership. In the Middle East, the game is played for keeps. It says Trump's nastiest insults must seem to them like child's play. Do you think maybe we could use a few days here to figure out the details before the President of the United States casts his judgment on the matter? It seems reasonable. It does seem reasonable, but not to a very unreasonable press that is obsessed with making every story about Donald Trump. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. The developed nations have made awesome progress. They have produced a highly mechanized world, providing every luxury, modern convenience, and means of pleasure. Yet they are cursed with crime, violence, injustice, sickness and disease, broken homes and families. At the same time, more than one half the world is living in illiteracy, abject poverty, filth and squalor. Violence and destruction are rapidly multiplying. Many ask, why, if God exists, does he allow so much violence and human suffering? To understand the reason behind this astonishing paradox, request a complimentary copy of Mystery of the Ages. We were born into this 20th century world as it is. We take it for granted, but we can't explain it. It's like viewing a movie at a point already near the end. We see what is occurring at that point, but not having seen it from the beginning and not knowing how events developed to the point of viewing, we simply cannot understand what we are seeing. Mystery of the Ages transports you back to the beginning of the movie, to the foundation of this present evil world. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com. This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
Just a couple of stories here from the UK press before I get into the subject I'll conclude today's program with. This first one here from the Times of London, titled, History is Too White, Claim Academics. It says here that some have begun campaigning to make history less white and less Eurocentric. In fact, this has been something that's been going on for decades now. But it still isn't quite right. And so we've got to make it less Eurocentric, because, as it says here, schools and universities, after research, found that racism was a common experience among those studying the subject. I mean, there's racism in the history departments. The people, I guess they're saying they purposely want it to be more about the whites or the Europeans. It says the Royal Historical Society is spearheading a campaign to make history more diverse. Further on, the report says that 89% of history and philosophy students are white, compared to 77% of all students, and that racism is a common experience of black and ethnic minority staff and students in history departments. That's from the Times. And then if you switch over to the Telegraph, you switch it to the Telegraph, and it says here, in the title, that the focus on slavery is putting black children off history. In this case, the focus is so much on slavery that blacks prefer not to get into history, period. It says, teachers must stop devoting so much time to slavery because it puts black children off history. So says the Royal Historical Society. It's the same. I just now noticed that. This is the same group, the Royal Historical Society, which on the one hand says it's too white. And then the same group says in another article that the focus on slavery is turning black students off. It's sad what's happening to our schools. It's sad how many are driven by some kind of ideological agenda, instead of just getting into a love for history. David McCullough, I've played quotes from him in recent months, quite a few, in fact. But he just talks about how much a love of history, how rewarding it can be. Just stripping away the bias and digging in. Well, this is something that a lot of young people are not doing. And they're not being taught. And they're not being taught. If they are being taught, they're not being taught by historians who love it, or teachers who love history. Listen to him as he describes, just a few years ago, this is from 2014, the problem that you see in schools today. This is clip number 6.
I am very concerned about the fact that we are raising generations of young Americans who are by and large historically illiterate. And I see it everywhere. The questions I'm asked, the things I'm told by students in some of the best universities in our country. I'm teaching a seminar at Dartmouth one day, and I started off a morning's class by saying, how many of you know who George C. Marshall was? He was all seniors, all history majors, all honor students, not one knew who George C. Marshall was. I had a young woman come up to me at the University of Missouri, thank me for coming to the university that day. She's a sophomore. She said, until I heard your talk this morning, I never realized that all the original 13 colonies were on the East Coast. At another university, of which I won't name, there was a question and answer period, and one of my questions was, aside from Harry Truman and John Adams, how many other presidents have you interviewed?
That's David McCullough. It's somewhat comical. It's so bad. But he's pointing out the historical illiteracy that you see on so many campuses today. And if you remember in some of the older programs or our programs from a few months ago, I mean, way back 15, even 20 years ago, he was talking then. He was sounding the alarm then about just how bad it is today. And that's more recent, that clip that you heard right there. These are from 2014. He's written all these books. He's visited all these campuses. And yet this is what he sees. These are the people that he meets on campus. And it's because this subject is seen as dull or unimportant, And it shouldn't be. It should be the most important subject in school. Never dull. Listen to what he said in this same lecture, clip 3.
History should never, in my view, ever be dull. It shouldn't be taught as dull. It shouldn't be written as dull, because it's anything but dull. It's not about dates and provisos and quotations. All that's, you look up in a book. History is about people. History is human. When in the course of human events, Jefferson wrote, the operative word is human. And so you have to get to know the people. You have to get inside their lives, put yourself in their shoes, and remember that none of them knew how it was going to come out any more than we know how it's going to come out in our time.
They didn't know, but as I've told my students here recently, I mean, one thing that we do know, we in God's church, is that God intervenes in the affairs of men. And so you can look back at historical events, or more specifically, at people, as he says there, and then the events that they were involved in, and then also see the hand of God. I mean, this makes it all the more exciting to study. We've been getting to know, in that sense, Winston Churchill, going back to the last couple of books that we read for our book club here at Edstone, and then more recently, as you probably know, John Adams, this book that David McCullough wrote back in 2001, last week at the end of Friday's program, we went through some of the, just what set apart that family, the uniqueness of that family. John Adams, his wife Abigail, they had 4 children. John Quincy, of course, went on to become the 6th president of the United States. And of course, in the case of John, the father, he was the driving force behind American independence. Jefferson said he was the colossus of independence. He was the one that moved us from our seats, Jefferson wrote. And you can read about some of those congressional sessions and some of the contentious subjects that came up. And when to declare independence, for example. And I mean, the most significant player in the midst of it all was John Adams. And as I was saying last night at our latest meeting, I mean, here this colossus of independence, this driving force, if you then delve into a study of his life and you see how much he loved the Bible, how much he was shaped by religion, well, you start connecting the dots, and you see how significant then this education, this training in religion and morality, how much it impacted the drawing up of those foundational documents on which the United States stands today. Well, it's not standing very firm. We're pretty wobbly right now, because we're getting away from that foundation. Following last week's program, I received this quote from one of our listeners. She sent me this statement that Abigail Adams made, or that she told to her son, John Quincy. And this is what she's telling her son about God. It's from March 20th, 1780. And she says to John Quincy, "The only sure and permanent foundation of virtue is religion. Let this important truth be engraven upon your heart, and also that the foundation of religion is the belief of the one only God, and a just sense of his attributes as a being infinitely wise, just, and good, to whom you owe the highest reverence, gratitude, and adoration, who superintends and governs all nature, even to clothing the lilies of the field, and hearing the young ravens when they cry, but more particularly regards man, whom he created after his own image. His own image. It says later on, for the attainment of which he is bound to the performance of certain duties, which all tend to the happiness and welfare of society, and are comprised in one short sentence, expressive of universal benevolence, thou shalt love your neighbor as yourself. Well, I think that that religious training and discipline from his earliest years, I think that had a lot to do with shaping John Quincy Adams, one of the most brilliant presidents the United States has ever had. Talk about educated. His family was passionate about religion when John arrived in Philadelphia for the Second Congress. This was in early 1776. McCullough says that on Sundays, that was his one day of rest, and that Adams was at church most of the day, attending services two or three times on Sundays, his day off. And McCullough says that when he got to Philadelphia, he was looking, I mean, he's going through basically every denomination, looking for a preacher who spoke the Word of God with passion. That's what he really wanted in an instructor. Indifference was a quality that Adams found difficult to tolerate. That's what McCullough writes about him. And then when he found a preacher that he really liked, he told his wife, Abigail, he reaches the imagination and he touches the passions very well. I mean, this is a passionate preacher, a passionate speaker. That's what he was looking for. And we've been told by my father and in so many articles at thetrumpet.com, in recent years in particular, that we really do have to have a passion for God's purpose and plan, a passion for God's empire, for God's kingdom. The God family empire is not something that we want to be timid about. We don't want to have any indifference when it comes to the God family. We want to see this empire, this family expand. We want to be passionate about its growth. I mean, we're confident in our cause, aren't we? The Apostle Peter said that we always have to be ready to give an answer for the hope that lies within. We want to be ready to step forward, to give an answer, to speak for God, to stand up for the truth of God. If you look at the Bible-based education that John Quincy received, that John and Abigail sought after all throughout their lives, I think it's interesting, too, as I said last night to our club, that John Adams was so fascinated with human nature, and he didn't think it was something that was just innately good. He and his wife would often recite a line from a poem by Daniel Defoe that said, "Remember, all men would be tyrants if they could." I mean, look at the truth of that statement today. Look at the rulers and leaders that we have in the world today. He had a fascination with human nature, Adams did. And that had a lot to do with why they drew up the government the way that they did, with all these checks and balances to prevent human nature from just turning into a tyrant, because that's just the way we'd go if we could. If we didn't have law, if we didn't have government, it had to be a nation of law. I played that clip for you last week. It had to be an empire of law and government. That was something that Adams himself said. An empire of laws and not of men. He borrowed that line, but he used it often. Adams had the clearest idea of anyone in Congress of what independence would actually entail, the great difficulties and risks, no less than the opportunities. McCullough says that he considered the end. He wanted, quite unlike Thomas Paine in Common Sense, as popular as that book was, and as much as it really did help the cause of independence, that booklet, Adams told his wife, I mean, it's for the most part, it's about pulling down, not building up. Okay, if we pull it down, if we get our independence, then what? Then what do? Then we have to build this empire of laws and not of men. The rule of law. And so they set out, the founders did, to establish a democratic republic, not a pure democracy, but a democratic republic based upon the rule of law, where there would be a constitution and a bill of rights that would protect certain unalienable rights, rights that the government cannot take away, rights that a majority of U.S. citizens cannot take away, like they could if it was just a pure democracy. That's what many are pushing for today, many coming from the radical left. They just want the pure democracy where the 51% has total control. And that's nothing more than a tyranny. Tyranny of the mob. Mob rule, as opposed to a tyrannical king of some sort. Well, as I say, get your own copy of that John Adams biography. There's quite a few of them in used bookstores if you'd like to read along. We're through chapter 2, and we'll be moving through chapter 3 this next week. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today. Thank you for joining us all through this week. And we'll see you next week. On Monday, we'll be broadcasting live from London. See you then.